We have to be kind. We have to desire the good, even for those who are persecuting us. But we don't always have to do it by being sweet and slightly pent up like this. We can also laugh.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Emma Fowle. The Profile is a show where we sit down with a well-known Christian to hear more about their life, their faith and their ministry. It's brought to you in association with Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. The monthly title features more interviews just like this one, as well as all of the latest news, reviews, columnists and much, much more. Plus, there's great new digital content uploaded daily to our website, premierchristianity.com. To get full access wherever you are in the world, there are print and digital subscription options to suit you. Get the magazine delivered directly to your door or access all of the latest content via your computer, your smartphone or the Premier Christianity app. Head over to premierchristianity.com/subscribe for more information. So today on The Profile, I'm really excited to be joined by author and creative writing professor Francis Spufford for a very special edition of The Profile, which forms part of our November creative series. So Francis, welcome to The Profile. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just get started with a little bit of background about you. You mention in a couple of your books that you grew up in a home that had a Christian faith in it. Could you tell us a little bit about the role that faith played in your early years in your home life?
This is the 1960s and 70s we're talking about, when Christianity in England was much more, you know, kind of just a taken for granted part of ordinary life. I grew up on a university campus in the Midlands at Keele. Both my parents were serious and convinced churchgoers, so we went to the parish church up the road as a kind of matter of course. In fact, my mother wrote a Christian book in the middle of her career as a historian. My father had considered sometime in the 1950s possibly going for the ministry himself, but had been bitten harder by the history bug. But for both of them, faith was a kind of integrated part of their lives and of the way they did their thinking. My mother was completely delighted by the idea that she was busily trying to work out the lives of people in the 17th century from tiny little archival traces, but she liked to say kind of they knew, since they were now with God, they knew the meaning of their lives much better than any historian would, and she looked forward to discussing it with them later.
That's so sweet. And for you, you write a book called
The Child the Books Built.
And you talk in that about your childhood love of books and of reading and of stories. And I loved reading that because it's beautiful when a book says the things about your own life that you feel to be real. My husband has said many a time to me that when I get engrossed in a book, he loses me to the world. So when I read those opening chapters and you talked about the world just disappearing from around you, I was like, that's me.
I'm glad to meet another one. But I was slightly taking refuge in books as well, because I had my younger sister Bridget, who was ill with a ridiculously rare genetic illness that before the 1960s would have killed you as an infant and since then has become curable. But back in those days, you could just about stay alive at the forefront of medical knowledge. So my parents were run off their feet looking after her, and I loved my ill little sister a lot, but also couldn't quite bear to face the reality of what was happening. So some of the reading I did was oh, here's a door, let me just rush through it. And if I couldn't hear what was going on around me, maybe that was a bit of a bonus. So I loved most of all books that took you away. The Narnia books most of all, but you know, anything anything fantastic that would send you off travelling in time and space.
I think many people can probably relate to elements of that story in different ways, and I think that's one of the beautiful things that stories do for us, isn't it? That ability to escape where we are or what's going on around us. But intersecting with your faith, how does that work for you? How did it work as a child? Did it change over the years? Is escape a good thing for you in terms of thinking about it from a Christian point of view?
Yeah, escape is a mixed thing, isn't it? Because escape is both a liberation from what is confining and trapping in your close-up circumstances, but also it can be a way of running away and not facing what's painful in life. And the first kind of escape is good, and the second kind of escape is not so good, and I think they tend to come mixed up together. I did most of my believing as a child through a kind of Narnian filter. I would have been very happy if God just was Aslan. And it was, you know, it wound its way into my thoughts and feelings. I got equipped with that kind of kit of Bible stories that turns out to be so useful later in making sense of the world and understanding history and knowing what's going on in all those oil paintings at the National Gallery. And I got confirmed when I was 13, and then promptly kind of teenage atheism arrived, and I lost all interest in Christianity and would have thought, you know, apart from a faint nostalgic sense that my parents were good people, that it was unnecessary, that I didn't get what the adult point of it was. And then discovered slowly and awkwardly what the adult point of it was in my 30s, when I found I needed it. I was in a room full of Christians, and someone said, let's go through and you know, raise your hand for the year in your life when you committed yourself to the faith. And one by one, every other hand in the room came up, and there was me waiting for the age of 35 to come round before I could do it. But I did get there in the end.
I think many people will have that a similar sort of up and down relationship with faith. It's one of the things that is, you know, especially if you grow up in a Christian home. I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I became a Christian when I was in my young teenage years, but still had the wilderness years of university, wandered away, got distracted, had to find my way back from it to it again as an adult. So I don't think it's very uncommon, is it? What was it for you that was the turning point that made you go back to what you've been brought up with?
I'm going to put it in a bracket first. No, I don't think it is that uncommon. I find that almost everybody's story, particularly the story of their coming to faith, tends to have more in common than it has differently. But it is also always individual and with unexpected bits in it. Close bracket. Right. I'm in my mid-30s. I've got married. I perform one of the classic destructive male mistakes of midlife. My marriage is in apparently terminal trouble, and I can't for the life of me see any rational reason why anything should get any better and why I haven't messed things up completely and for good. And the news that there might be something to hope for after all comes to me sitting miserably in a cafe in the form of Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, which somebody quite rightly has described as being like what mercy would sound like if it had a sound. And what spoke to me about it was that it's very beautiful, but it's also quite sad, and it's like a kind of completely realistic bit of music. It doesn't go, everything's fine, really. It goes, everything's not fine. You really have made the mistakes you've made. But that's not all there is to it. There is more to the story than that. There is mercy in the world, which you don't have to deserve. Probably other people will be recognising parts of this by now. But it took me quite a long time to act on that, or even to work out how I was supposed to be acting on that. I had the advantage of having, you know, once been a believing child. So it did tend to be churches that I wandered into to sit quietly at the back on my own, thinking, what am I supposed to do with this sensation? But it took me a little while to discover that the message I was getting, courtesy of Mr. Mozart, was actually ultimately coming from God. And bit by bit, that actually there's nothing childish about Christianity at all. It is a profoundly realistic religion where human behaviour is concerned, and it is just there waiting for adults who mess up and see no way out of the idiotic messes, or worse than that, that they have got themselves into. And bit by bit, I discovered this is sounding more abstract than it actually was at the time, because the idea bit is always easier to describe than the emotional bit. But all right, here's the idea bit.
Yeah.
Bit by bit, I discovered that Christianity gave a kind of account of what it was like to be a human and how that worked, which seemed more true, more complete, more wise, more kind, more satisfying than any of the other ones. But talking about it as ideas is misleading. What actually happened is that kindness with a capital K, wisdom with a capital W, even a bit of justice with a capital J, because, you know, you do really have to try and make restitution for the things you messed up, reached out towards me. What I discovered was that it wasn't just about me and the ideas in my head, that you reach out a hand, another much bigger hand comes back reaching for you.
Yeah, that's interesting what you're saying. Like, there are several questions I'd like to ask you out of that, but one of them is this idea that you said, obviously having had the background that you had, that a lot of that information and knowledge was already sort of stored away from those childhood Bible stories that you'd heard and learned. So for you, it was kind of a rediscovering of some truths that you already knew. It's a different story, isn't it? Perhaps if you've never been a Christian or never had any Christian upbringing at all or input, and for many people in today's society, that's more true, as you were saying earlier, than from the world that you were raised in the 60s. You know, where do you think we go with that as a society? Is it a problem? Is it not a problem?
I think it's both a problem and an opportunity. It's a problem because it means that there is always now far more work to be done from scratch in trying to reach out with good news. You can't explain to people that, you know, great, you're redeemed, if they have no idea what that means, no sense they might to be redeemed from anything. There's a lot more groundwork that has to be done these days. That's the problem part. On the opportunity side, a lot of the hostility that there was to Christianity is fading away into incomprehension. But I'd rather have incomprehension than hostility in some ways. The generation who were forced to sing All Things Bright and Beautiful, well, kind of gritting their teeth and going, I hate this, I'll never ask a child to go through this in my family. You know, they've raised their kids, that is over, and it's going away. But in some ways, it feels weird speaking for Christians and saying we, but we now have to behave as if we're in a society where we're genuinely announcing something that no one has ever suspected before.
Yeah. Would you have counted yourself in that number of the generation that really pushed back against it?
Or sorry,
it
I'm just... talking at the same time, because yes. I remember that part of my teenage rebellion against God was finding churches, the physical buildings of churches, intensely uncomfortable, as if they were trying to get at me in some way. So once I had, you know, power over my own legs, I walked myself out of there so that unpleasant sensation couldn't be there anymore. And in a funny way, it was once I was convinced that churches were empty and there wasn't anything in there trying to get me, that you know, I was making less noise in my head, so I could start to pay attention to what might really be there, and it wasn't trying to get me.
And when you started your journey back towards faith, was that something you did on your own? Was it an academic exercise for you, being an academic, or was
No.
Did you have people around you that helped you?
That's just rationalising. Well, my wife, with whom I've made a terrible mess of things, is a believer and is in fact an Anglican vicar now, cathedral canon. She has always been a large influence on my faith. So that.
And what did that look like in the early years? Because you've been together since you're at uni.
Gaps and major mistakes, but which I'm not going to get too specific about because they're not just my shames and sins. they are my shames and sins, but it's not my. Other people's privacy is involved. So
completely. Yeah. But you've known each other a long time.
She's always had
a faith. So how did that work? You know, in your atheist years,
she didn't push it, which was wise, and she wasn't always the right person to talk to about it when I started my journey back.
My parents split up when I was a teenager, shortly after I became a Christian. My dad had an affair and several other terrible things. And when my mum became a Christian and then my dad became a Christian later, one of the first things she said was, "He's not coming to our church. This is my safe space. You go find somewhere else to sort yourself out. And I think, you know, at times there's certain wisdom in that in a relationship, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
You sort your own spiritual lives out with other wise people rather than each other.
You can converge again later once you've allowed kind of mercy to do its necessary work on you. I mean, I've been a vicar's husband now for heavens nearly 20 years, so it's not like we didn't get it together in the end.
Yeah. What's that like, being a vicar's husband?
Slightly weird in that I'm quite a lot less holy than she is, but there is a kind of slightly alarming glow. I'm not saying she literally glows, but
maybe she does,
but maybe it's just that I think of her like that. But there is a kind of church umbrella which the vicar or the minister's family finds themselves underneath as well. Not always the easiest place to grow up, as my daughter has found. Yeah. But you find in some ways that you've entered a kind of slightly weird family business where kind of attempting to manifest the love of God is kind of what you do. Mm. And I'm not that good at it. But
it's quite interesting talking to a man about this, because quite often we hear the tropes about vicars' wives and the expectations that's placed on the pastor's wife. So I've never actually spoken to a male who holds this.
We get it much easier. And I have to now fess up and go, men have a much easier time of it thanks to the evils of the double standard, because I found that if nobody ever asked me to be president of the Guild of Needlewomen or to do the final hour arranging, and if I could be competent at all at cooking a lasagna for 12, people would go, "Oh, well done." Clap, 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 clap.
No one ever wanted you to run the preschool.
They didn't. Though I did actually run the Sunday school at one point, but people were surprised and delighted rather than going, "Well, naturally she's doing it." Mm. Vicar's husbands, I think, have a like a twice as easy ride as vicar's wives. But there is something, I don't know if I can describe this properly, but there is something about being in a whole load of human encounters, not just yourself, but trying to represent something beyond you and far beyond your own powers to do, which is it's a peculiar discipline, and I've no idea whether I've ever done it at all well. But it's part of goodness. I'm not that good at doing goodness either, but there's something about facing towards God and the good which is very rewarding.
You open unapologetic by talking about your then 6-year-old daughter, who I'm guessing now is somewhere in her late teens.
17, going on 18.
Same age as my oldest. Saying that she's just about to learn something, that her family is incredibly weird. So as the parent of teenage daughters, I just wanted to ask you, how has that worked out for you? Did she realise that you were weird?
She did realise that we were weird.
How did that happen?
The early years in which she would cry out happily to strangers as we bicycled to church, "Are you going to church too?" She stopped doing, because she discovered that most people actually weren't. They were off to play five-a-side football on Sunday mornings. She doesn't really enjoy the goldfish bowl aspect of living in a vicarage. and she's finding her own way. I think she's probably more of a Buddhist than a Christian at the moment, but I'm quietly confident that I really hope she's not going to listen to this, because I'm quietly confident that she'll find her way back in her own good time. Was I whispering that loudly enough?
It's a very unique experience growing up with ministers as parents, isn't it?
It is.
My father speaks since he became a Christian. He sort of has travelled around the world telling his testimony. He's never been a minister, but it's a very odd experience when your parents are very prominent in that world, and the church world is quite small in the UK.
Yeah.
So it becomes a bit of its own pressure, really, doesn't it?
And there is always this issue about how personal you should be if you are if you are offering testimony or telling your own life story. And as I found when I was writing Unapologetic, which is my attempt to explain from scratch for people who don't have their heads already handily stocked with Bible stories, you have to tell your own story, because that's how you demonstrate that actually Christianity isn't abstract and it makes sense in a life. You go, here's this life, which happens to be my life. Mm. You can recognise some stuff here. And even though yours is different, we're talking about life-shaped problems here. But then there is always the question about, you know, how much is too much? Whose privacy is yours to dispose of? Mm. How much you can say before you're being, you know, before someone cries TMI.
Yeah.
You're a sinner, that's all I needed to know. You don't have to name the individual sins.
So let's talk about Unapologetic.
All right.
It's a great book. It's one of my favourites. Did you get much pushback from the Christian community over the overly sweary aspects of it?
A little bit, but actually far less than I'd expected. I think it was a particular moment when I was writing it, when the kind of the Richard Dawkins wave was at its height, and I thought there are lots of responses to The God Delusion and the other New Atheist bestsellers, which are painstakingly kind of careful, all about the ideas, full of philosophical argument, and go, Mr. Dawkins, I'm afraid you've got the theology slightly wrong here, and none of them quite did the job, because he was really just doing a kind of fire hose of enjoyable scorn. And I thought, we should have a fire hose of our own, really. Why do Christian books always have to be so overwhelmingly well behaved? You know, we shouldn't be nasty, we shouldn't be evil, but we could be funny. And we can, if people's ideas of us are ridiculous, we ought to be able to say so. So I set out to write something which explained from scratch, while being fast on its feet and funny and occasionally quite mischievous, and as part of that, sweary. But looking back, I think to myself, was the sweariness really necessary? It was a solution to telling people that Christians don't always speak in soft, restrained voices like this, and that our faith does not exist in some sort of glass dome where even a loud sudden movement might suddenly shatter it. And I thought the quick way to do that is just to arrive in a sort of leery way with your elbows out. But actually talking laddishly about your faith was only one way of doing it, and I'm not sure it was the best way of doing it looking back 12 years, 13 years later, whatever it is.
You have to admit, you just wanted to be the Bono of Christian apologetics.
Yeah, I know. But ever since it came out, people have been meeting me and being slightly disappointed that I'm not quite the persona they met on the page.
Because I'm more rock star.
I am a bit sweary, but I'm not that sweary, and I never swear in church. And I draw a nice hard line between profanity, okay, and blasphemy, not okay. But I don't know if I do it that way anymore. But it sort of did the job of being not in the tone of voice that people were, you know, people were expecting.
Yeah, and sometimes there's something about taking an unexpected approach to something that sort of grabs people's attention a little bit, yeah, isn't there? And I do definitely think there is something about that idea that Christian creativity, whether it's art or music or literature or just Christians in general, have to be, like you say, eternally and forever nice and kind and polite. And of course, yeah, we do. But
no, hang on, let's distinguish here. We have to be kind. We have to desire the good, even for those who are persecuting us. But we don't always have to do it by being sweet and slightly pent up like this. We can also laugh.
Yeah, and that is, you know, genuinely something probably that puts a lot of people off of Christianity, isn't it? That kind of image of the pearl and twin sets and the archetypal Church of England Sunday morning. And for a lot of people, that is not something that relates to their life.
Indeed. And also, it's cobblers in terms, to use a technical theological term there, it's cobblers in terms of the actual reach of the faith. Christianity is about the whole of human life. It is not afraid of the dark bits, the messy bits, the untidy bits, the bad-tempered bits, the dull bits, the troublesome bits, the bits whose meaning you really can't work out but trust that God can. I mean, it's big and realistic and unafraid of anything that the human condition can throw up. And that doesn't sound to me like a recipe for a polite, nervous little voice.
Yeah, so what you're basically saying is God is not as easily offended as sometimes we may think he is.
Quite. I don't think God is offended in the human sense by anything. We are assured that there is literally nothing we can do that will cause God to turn away and give up on us. There are obviously things that God would prefer we didn't do, but he seems to be committed, luckily for us.
Yeah, but there are things obviously that he doesn't like in us and that he would have us change.
Yes, but it's never a reason to turn away. There's no parable that goes, we won't bother to track down that lost sheep because, ugh, rather unsightly one. No,
I was going to say, I think it's probably the things that we may be surprised at, the things actually that God will have us change.
Yeah, point. I mean, we are classically bad at working out what our most important sins are. The things we are most guilty about may well be a mere sideshow compared to the stuff that God would most like us to have changed.
So let's talk about creativity, because obviously you're a professor of creative writing. So one of the things you do is teach creative writing and have done for a long time. And obviously you've a lifelong love of stories and storytelling and reading them and writing them, and you write non-fiction and fiction and everything in between, it seems. So for you, how does your faith intersect with your creativity as a writer and a storyteller?
This is a surprisingly tricky question. To begin with, I used to try out the idea of going, I'm not a Christian writer, I'm just a writer who happens to be a Christian, but that can't be quite true because my Christianity doesn't exist in some sort of separate box which I close when I write. It influences the way you understand everything. So naturally it influences the way I write and what I write about as well. I tend not to be drawn to... Maybe people will have guessed this by now, judging by my defence of swearing a minute ago, but I tend not to be drawn to writing stories about people who know they're trying to lead the Christian in life. What I tend to do is to write stories that have got a kind of theological bottom layer, like a kind of underlay in the carpet of the story, which the characters don't necessarily know is there, but which is there, and in which the lives of the people I'm writing about fall into shapes of redemption, really. It seems to me to be a very important truth that the Holy Spirit is not just active within the church. The Holy Spirit is not that selective, again, fortunately. And all lives are being constantly nudged towards grace, forgiveness, and the good. And put that together with Christianity not being afraid of any bit of human behaviour, and you seem to me to have a recipe for a kind of universal curiosity about everything and everyone, and also a kind of, how can I put this, a sort of moral commitment to trying for a universal sympathy, even with people who have done dreadful things, that literature shouldn't stop trying to understand people no matter what. I mean, obviously, we writer can't be like God except in some sort of tiny, tiny way. but trying to understand your imagined people as you hope, as you guess, as you feel that God understands all of us without limit. So it seems to me that as a Christian, I am helplessly and endlessly telling stories which are like kind of tracings of the gospel story, even if it's not visible to most readers, even if it's not always visible to me when I start writing the things, and as I get towards the end, I think, oh, I've told that story again. It's redemption, isn't it? Oh well.
Well, I think there's lots of people that would argue that even if a story or a piece of art or a piece of music is not intrinsically created specifically to tell a gospel story, that the gospel is the greatest story ever told, and that therefore, you know, it kind of is embedded in all of the stories that we tell as humans, isn't it?
How can it not intrinsically reflect? We should have the confidence of going, you know, it's a universal message, and universal really means universal. It means that everything in creation, whether it knows it or not, whether you know it or not, is bending gently towards the purposes of the one message and the one story.
Does that influence your teaching at all? Like,
now you're on even trickier ground. I don't talk about my faith unless other people ask about it. It's a matter of sort of kind of teaching ethics. I don't want to get between other people and whatever it is that they're working on. But now and again, people have asked.
And I assume because of writing books like Unapologetic, everyone knows you're a Christian.
Quite, so. No. So it's not like I'm keeping a secret of it. Yeah. I'm just not shouting about it unless invited.
Do you have any thoughts on the idea that whether it's music or writing, that some publishers or publishing houses may sort of shy away from telling stories of the Christian faith? Because, you know, there is that perception that maybe that telling the stories of Christianity in particular is something that publishers are not too keen on.
There's some sort of lingering historical prejudice, which has to do, I think, probably with the kind of generation that is, I say passing away as if I'm eager for them to be dead, but I'm really not. But I think the point where there is active hostility to Christianity in the culture, and therefore in the culture industries, is going with this useful incomprehension following on. But yeah, people are wary of explicit Christianity because it may be embarrassing and because they think it may be propaganda. And also, you know, not being rude, but some of the things that go by the name of Christian art are not very good. And some of the attempts to create a kind of little parallel worlds of specially Christian music or entertainment seem to me to settle for a world that's too small, and then other people outside it go, no, we don't want that, it's too little. I don't know quite how you get out of that particular bind. It helps. I mean, there is a weird sense in which if you're not white, Christianity is more easily accepted as part of your kind of your cultural history and your and the kind of the package of things which it's okay for you to care about.
Yeah, you're right. We often see black artists, actors, musicians speaking about their faith openly, often at award ceremonies and things like that. But you're right, we very rarely see white Christians being so openly expressive about the Christian faith in the same way in the public sphere.
And it's partly just to do with the kind of the cultural vibe that black British Christianity or African British Christianity has compared to, you know, my own dear Church of England, which is kind of, it's not very cool as an institution, I have to say. But we've got lovely flower arranging. Come on down.
But is it, I think, as I completely agree with you, I have over the years as an avid reader lamented quality Christian writing. But it's interesting to me that you kind of get the odd outliers, don't you? The breakthrough things like The Shack that suddenly like takes the world by storm and ends up on airport bookshelves. And I think, how do we do that again? Like, I'd love to see
I'm
more.
Not sure it's a repeatable formula. but at the kind of the top end of literary fiction, Marilyn Robinson, when Gilead comes out and suddenly a great many people who know it's a wonderful book find themselves very curious about the kind of the world of faithful feeling that's in it. And they don't necessarily get it. They don't necessarily want to go there themselves, but they respond strongly. But I'm not sure. I haven't got a master plan that is any more than write good books one at a time.
That's a shame.
Sorry.
I'm very interested in hearing that.
Yeah, but you know, it's really interesting though, isn't it? Because you do get those artists. I'm thinking of people like Stormzy, who are very much in the public eye, that are hugely respected, like massive megastars within the industry, but also do tell those stories of faith quite strongly through their art. So, you know, the question is, how do we do that? You know, interestingly, thoughtfully,
and fearlessly. Let's add that one as well, because part of that is not being afraid of public reactions. I say this because it's one who's had a very lucky life in which I got well known first before I came out as a Christian, so in some ways I did it the cowardly way round. but also fearlessly, in the sense of not being afraid of difficult subject matter, not behaving as if we are restricted to some quiet, good-mannered little theme park of human emotions. We should behave in line with what we actually believe, that the whole thing, the whole deal, all of human life is open for intelligent and wonderful Christian artistry. The Renaissance would be, you know, full of artists who would agree with you instantly about that, and we should get some of our cultural confidence back. There's something here about not being afraid, not being timid, not being limited, but also never settling for propaganda or sentiment, always making things we think are true. We have a God of truth, so it doesn't really matter if we're uncomfortable.
Too many of us are living in a bubble and not hearing both sides of the world's important stories. It's time for a more rounded perspective. It's time to discover Premier Christianity. Balanced, confident, relevant, faith-filled. Discover fresh biblical perspectives as we bring you wide-ranging stories that impact the church. Discover the go-to source for Christian news. Subscribe at premierchristianity.com. Now only £5 for 3 months.
So you've written non-fiction, you've written apologetics, you've written fiction. Your fiction tends to be fairly wild.
Thank you.
Is that a good way to describe it?
I don't know, but I'm really pleased by it as a description.
You've written two books that are, the two novels that you've written are both based in America, in a historical world that is sort of part based on history and part imagined.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it takes in a lot of different themes, and maybe that's partly reflected by the breadth of the reading you said you loved as a child. Tell us about your latest novel.
The new one, Cahokia Jazz, which is a novel set in a slightly different version of American history where Native Americans didn't die of European diseases in huge tragic numbers, but were still there, growing maize and ready to be converted by dedicated missionaries from the Roman Catholic Church coming up the River Mississippi from Mexico. So now being 1920s in the novel, there's a big city mostly populated by piously Catholic Native Americans on the banks of the Mississippi, and there's a murder on a rooftop, and there's a conflicted detective, because you have to have a conflicted detective, who isn't sure whether he should be a policeman or a jazz pianist, and a week of ever wilder events, including enormous crowd scenes and rooftop dramas. And I love rooftop dramas. My previous novel had a rooftop drama too. And heading for somewhere which, if you happened to be a Christian, you would recognise was a drama of redemption. But it needs to work, even if you don't recognise that. I should say, not just America. My previous book was about London. Light Perpetual was a book about London over the last 50 or 60 years. And again, if you're a Christian, you'll probably recognise that light perpetual is one of the phrases that comes up when people are doing funerals and praying for the dead, because I wanted to write a book about time in human lives and eternity and how time and eternity can possibly fit together, and how even grubby, wonderful old London can be a kind of suburb of the city of God.
You managed to pack a lot into your fiction undertakings. You've got a bit of history, a bit of theology, a bit of made-up world. A bit of, like,
And let's not forget the rooftop drama.
And the rooftop dramas.
Yeah.
Are you going to make sure one of those goes into every book that you write from now on?
I couldn't possibly say. But one thing I have done, which I didn't notice while I was doing it, is that every single novel I've published has got a church service of some description in it. I've got an old-fashioned Book of Common Prayer morning service. I've got a full-on Pentecostal service with long sermon and gospel music. The new one has got a mass in Latin in it, and I'm working towards some sort of Christmas even song in the next one, but because I've spotted that I keep doing this, and I'm now going to work my way through every possible kind of service.
Amazing. I think it's great, because I think that is one of the problems I see in the portrayal of Christianity within the storytelling world, whether it's TV dramas or films or books, is quite often when a Christian does pop up, they're either incredibly weird or incredibly sinister.
Yeah.
So it's quite nice just to have it portrayed as a part of life. Like, it doesn't even have to be the main part of a story.
Yes,
it
absolutely.
Just needs to be, this is part of the human experience.
I make a special point of doing it when I'm writing historical fiction, even if the history is slightly weird and made up, because it's odd the way that historical novels now mostly leave out church from the past, when church was such a large accepted part of life in the past. So when I was writing my last book, but two, with a mysterious bad boy known as Mr. Smith turning up in 18th century New York, he does take himself to church, and he is a bad boy, and he makes some terrible mistakes, but it's Sunday morning, so he goes to church. And I thought there is a challenge here to describe this so that it's not a kind of freaky alien thing he does, but a perfectly ordinary piece of human activity. I don't know. I have faith that we're passing through some sort of narrow times for Christianity, but it'll broaden out again. People will get us without the need for enormous explanations again. You just give it another century or so.
Down for that. I'm praying for that.
So what would you say to those Christians who perhaps think that the Bible is all we need, that don't enjoy engaging with fiction, or don't believe that it's a useful or productive use of our time? I'm assuming that obviously you don't agree with that point of view, but what would you say to those Christians who do hold that view?
I have to break it to them that the Bible is full of stories. I can understand that, but there is a difference to my mind between saying that the Bible contains everything necessary for salvation and saying that you shouldn't do anything else. Just because it's got everything necessary in it doesn't mean that you can't enrich your life and enrich your life of faith by rejoicing in everything that human creativity can add to that, to go along with it on the journey. Also, there's another more kind of tightly Christian point to be made there, which is that every generation has the responsibility of building a new bridge between what is in scripture and what is going on in people's everyday experience in 1800, 1900, 2000, now, onwards into the future. There's always necessary to go, here's the book, here's your life, this is how you connect the book to your life, and storytelling is always going to be part of that. It's always essential to keep reimagining it for every generation. Because,
and if you go back to the 50s, you've got people like C.S. Lewis, obviously, that were
quite
demonstrating a masterclass in that. Now, even again, going back to people like Stormzy, they kind of are doing that, aren't they?
But it needs to be done differently for different times and different places, over and over again. It is part of the permanent duty, let's say duty, that's a really unenjoyable word, but duty of being a Christian, that you have to go on explaining yourself in terms that people will actually get, and just going kind of, I'm sorry, I wish to be alone with the New International Version, is not going to do it.
Always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have.
Exactly, even if sometimes it might involve a bit of swearing, although I'm not sure now that was the right way to go.
He wants to recant on the swearing.
I didn't want to recant on it. I want to say there might have been better ways, but it was what I could think of at the time.
Fair enough. Work in progress.
Yes, aren't we all a work in progress?
Exactly. Yeah, and just is an interesting point, isn't it? I was going to ask you a question there about creativity. You said something like everything that we can imagine and create like we should enjoy. But there must be limits to that, mustn't there?
There are. There is such a thing as, well, there's idolatry waiting around just to be a little bit of a problem. There are some kinds of imagining and enjoying which are not good for us. But they aren't the generous kind, and they aren't the kind which is fearlessly curious about other people's lives. They tend to be with enormous monotony, things that offer pleasures cheaper and simpler and cruder than real life. Ways of going kind of, you don't want that real meal. What you want is to eat a pound of sugar. Or that offer us lying substitutes for realism. I think there is nothing to fear in describing anything so long as the commitment to truthfulness is there. But it is possible to describe anything and twist it for a satisfaction which is a kind of escape from reality. And now we're back at the beginning of the conversation. That's the wrong kind of escape. Mm. We wish to escape from the jail cells of our limitations and our sins. We do not wish to escape from reality. Reality is the good stuff.
Yeah, and if you think about the generation that are growing up now and all the challenges they're facing, I'm thinking in particular with pornography and those types of challenges, they are being fed that lie, aren't they? That it's okay to escape from the realities of life by burying yourself in porn. And that's causing huge problems amongst our younger generation, isn't it?
Right. And that's not actually human sexuality. That's like a kind of embarrassing commercial knockoff of human sexuality.
You don't do social media, do you?
I don't do social media.
Why is that?
Partly because I have a suspicion that if I once started tweeting, I might never do anything else. But also because, and I may not come across this way, I'm actually quite shy, and I have a job as a writer partly so that I can sit in a room on my own going, what's the next adjective? And then I can come out of the room and chat to people and enjoy it, but on condition that I can go back in again. And I have this feeling that if I did social media, I might never be alone again. Let the record show that he shuddered at this point.
Yeah, and it's probably I've actually heard lots of creative people say that social media is not actually good for their creativity. I guess because so much of your time and attention, doesn't it? Sometimes
it
you need
does.
That blank space to
it is an instant sugar high available when what you actually need to be doing is is chewing away at something difficult you don't know quite how to do yet.
Okay, so as a lifelong lover of stories, you've already said that the Bible is full of fantastic stories. Do you have a favourite? What's your favourite Bible story and why?
It's the woman taken in adultery, which is not a fun story, but it is a life or death illustration of what Jesus' priorities are and therefore what God's priorities are.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.